My name is Reagan. Welcome to the Twisted States podcast, where we take a look, state by state, at some of America's most nefarious killers, elusive cryptids, and bizarre mysteries. This is episode 15, where we'll be delving into the mysterious circumstances that led to New England author and folklorist Joseph A. Citro coining the phrase, the Bennington Triangle, in 1992, referencing this portion of Vermont. I know it's been a while since last episode, but let's just get into it. If you want to find out more about what's going on the back end of things or whatever, check me out on Instagram, check out my Patreon, all that fun stuff. But right now, let's just get into this episode because there's a lot of ground to cover here. It's pretty interesting. With Canada to the north, Massachusetts to the south, New Hampshire to the east, and New York to the west, Vermont was the 14th state to join the Union on March 4th, 1791, and is the second least populated U.S. state after Wyoming. The most populous city, Burlington, is the least populous city to be the most populous city in a U.S. state. So let's take a look at the native history. Between 8500 and 7000 BCE, at the time of the Champlain Sea, Native Americans inhabited and hunted in present-day Vermont. During the archaic period from the 8th millennium BCE to 1000 BCE, Native Americans migrated year-round. During the woodland period from 1000 BCE to 1600 CE, they established villages and trade networks and developed ceramic and bow and arrow technology. Their population in 1500 CE was estimated to be around 10,000 people. During colonial times, where encounters and settlement were initiated by French colonists, the territory was occupied mainly by an Abenaki tribe known as Sakoki or Missisquoi. The eastern part of the state may have also been occupied by the Androscoggin and Penacook peoples. To the west, the Missisquoi competed with the Iroquois and Mohawk based in the Mohawk Valley, but with a large territory, and the Algonquin Mohican peoples. Many of the tribes later formed the Wabanaki Confederacy during King Philip's War. The warfare by English colonists defeated and scattered most of the surviving Abenaki tribes. Long before colonial times, local natives considered much of the area that we're going to be talking about today to be cursed. There are many tales of sightings of what many have dubbed the Bennington Monster in modern times in the area over the years, and quite a few people have talked of strange energy and weird kind of like blackouts, things along those lines. Centered around Glastonbury Mountain with no clearly defined borders, the Bennington Triangle encompasses the surrounding towns of Bennington, Woodford, Shaftesbury, Somerset, and Glastonbury along the Long Trail. Vermont's Long Trail follows the main ridge of the Green Mountains from the Massachusetts-Vermont line to the Canadian border. Built between 1910 and 1930, it was a vision of James P. Taylor and later became the inspiration for the Appalachian Trail. The LT and AT, Long Trail and Appalachian Trail, share 100 miles of trail in the southern part of the state. After the decline of the industrial and logging towns of Somerset and Glastonbury toward the end of the 19th century, the Vermont General Assembly formally unappropriated them in 1937, rendering them basically ghost towns. Beginning in 1945, a string of disappearances would cast a dark shadow on this area. Let's take a look at those unfortunate souls that went missing and see if we can get any insight into these bizarre, unsolved cases. Our first case happened in 1945. Mitty Rivers was 74 years old and no stranger to this region of wilderness. Rivers was employed at Benmont Papers and routinely enjoyed spending his free time hiking and hunting in the area of Bickford Hollow near Glastonbury Mountain, as he had for a few years. On November 9th, Mitty Rivers met up with four other hunters for a weekend to take advantage of deer season, as many others in the area were doing. One of the party members was Mitty's son-in-law, Joe Lawson Jr. As the hunting party was making their way back to camp around 3 p.m. on the 12th, Mitty Rivers got a bit ahead of his group and branched off toward a swampy area in Bickford Hollow. He assured his party members he'd be back to camp by lunchtime and refused additional provisions offered by members of his group. Rivers was dressed in a red and black plaid jacket, gray work shirt, gray pants, and a gray hunting cap. He was only carrying his hunting rifle, ammo, and a tobacco pipe with just a few matches, no bedding or other supplies. After lunchtime came and went, with the cold November night rapidly approaching, his party members began getting worried when he didn't return. Lawson Jr. reached out to Fire Chief Wallace Madison and informed him of Rivers' disappearance. Immediately, Madison gathered up a dozen people to go look for Rivers, to no avail. The following day, as word got out, a group of 15 co-workers of Maddie's joined in the search efforts. As the days ticked by, it became more and more of an air of being a recovery operation due to the amount of time passing and weather conditions. The fire chief reached out and attempted to get together at least 100 people to comb the wilderness, but due to many people being out hunting and this being a time long before social media and cell phones, it was hard to get the word out. About 40 people showed up, but still, there was no sign of Maddie Rivers to be found. On the 20th of November, search efforts were abandoned due to snow and the imminent fact that chances of him surviving that long in those circumstances was slim to none. Everyone was just so baffled as to where Rivers could have gone. One of his party members, Hollis Armstrong, was one of the last people to see him alive, and all he had to say was Rivers commented on knowing he was on the wrong side of the ridge. Many seasoned hunters in the area had cautioned Rivers on multiple occasions in the past about going on the other side of the ridge he would commonly hunt along due to rough terrain and issues crossing the creek. On November 23rd, search efforts resumed. A call was put out for anyone willing to join the search party by offering $4 a day to any volunteers. But despite a big turnout of locals, Boy Scouts, and military men in the area, no one put in a claim for the money. Despite their efforts, no headway was made in discovering the fate of one Maddie Rivers. One prevalent theory was that Maddie was swept away when trying to cross a creek and carried downriver outside of the area being searched. Another theory is that another hunter accidentally shot Rivers and hid the body to avoid possible prosecution. Some have blamed his disappearance on a local legend along the lines of a Bigfoot. And some have even blamed it on aliens. 76 years have passed with no new leads or evidence in any direction as to what happened to Maddie Rivers. So at this point, we may well never know what went on that cold November afternoon in Vermont. Just barely a year later, another disappearance was reported. Paula Jean Weldon was an 18-year-old sophomore at Bennington College, the eldest of four daughters of William Archibald Weldon and Jean Douglas Wilson. On the morning of December 1st, 1946, Paula went through her usual routine. After working a double shift at Bennington College dining hall, she returned to Dewey House, the dormitory she lived in while attending school. Paula studied for a bit, then became a little restless and asked around if anyone would be interested in checking out the long trail with her. Weldon was familiar with this popular trail and had been wanting to check it out for quite some time. After not having any luck finding someone to join her in her outing, she got dressed in jeans, sneakers, a simple top, and a red parka, and headed out alone around 2:45 p.m. Several sightings were reported along the long trail on the way and close to Bickford Hollow. One such sighting was by Bennington Banner employee Ernest Whitman. Paula approached Whitman and asked for directions and some general information about the trail. Another sighting was by an elderly couple along the trail, indicating they spotted Paula walking roughly 1,000 feet in front of them, and she eventually disappeared out of sight around a bend. The last confirmed sighting was in the vicinity of Fay Fuller Camp. Noticing Weldon hadn't returned by the following morning, Paula's roommate reported her missing. Paula's father, William A. Weldon, was a well-known designer, architect, and industrial engineer employed by Revere Copper and Brass Company. William used his status to help persuade law enforcement to do more. Due to Mr. Weldon's efforts and dissatisfaction in solving his daughter's case and locating her, he pushed local legislators to support the creation of the Vermont State Police. As before, several people joined in on search efforts and every option was explored to attempt to bring Paula home safely. To no avail. Paula was even less prepared than Maddie Rivers. She had no knowledge of the area, was not dressed for the inevitable cold evening that was approaching, and was carrying no supplies of any kind. Some of Paula's classmates stated she seemed a bit depressed. She hadn't returned home that year for Thanksgiving and seemed like she was having some kind of issues. One suspect was considered, Fred Gaudet, a lumberjack that lived in the area on Harbor Road. Fred was arguing with his girlfriend when Paula passed by, and there are two accounts given. One is that he went back to his cabin and spent the evening alone. The other is that he drove up the road along the travel portion of the trail in the direction Paula was walking. This would have been as it was starting to get dark, and puts a higher possibility out there that she may have climbed in the truck with him if promised a ride back to her dorm or in the direction of her college. Gaudet made several comments to people in regards to, quote, knowing within 100 feet where Walden was buried. But when questioned, he maintained that it was just idle talk and he was innocent. When the case was revisited in 1951, he was once again looked at as a suspect, but with no body and no evidence, he couldn't be formally charged. Of course, once again, many blame it on paranormal occurrences. Just as Rivers was, Paula was wearing red and disappeared in the same area without not a single trace of her to be found. 3 years later, on December 1st, 1949, victim number three, James E. Tedford, a veteran, went missing Twilight Zone style from a bus passing through the area. The bus was headed to Bennington. James was a resident of the Bennington Soldiers' Home on his way back from a visit with family in a neighboring town. Tedford was on the bus after the last stop and prior to its final destination, but when the bus arrived, all that was found was an empty seat with his open bus schedule laid across it, his luggage and belongings still neatly tucked into the overhead luggage rack. Nobody ever... It's not like they just, like, you know, he didn't just eat off the bus. He was there after the last stop. And even if he did get off somewhere along the way, they should have found him somewhere along the way at one of the stops, but no. And that blows my mind. I think that's one of the stranger ones out here, because he was on a bus and then he just wasn't. On October 12th of 1950, so the following year, Paul Jebson, an 8-year-old child, disappeared from a vehicle. Jebson had accompanied his mom in a truck. She left her son unattended in the truck while she fed some pigs. His mother was gone for about an hour. When she returned, her son was nowhere in sight. Search parties were formed to look for the child. Nothing was ever found, though Jebson was wearing a bright red jacket that should have made him more visible. According to one story, bloodhounds tracked the boy to a local highway where, according to local legend, 4 years earlier, Paula Weldon had disappeared. The fifth and final disappearance of this era occurred 16 days after Jebson had vanished. On October 28, 1950, Frieda Langer, 53, and her cousin Herbert Elsner left their family campsite near the Somerset Reservoir to go on a hike. During the hike, Langer slipped and fell into a stream. She told Elsner if he would wait, she would go back to the campsite, change clothes, and catch up to him. When she didn't return, Elsner made his way back to the campsite and discovered Langer had not returned to the campsite, and that nobody had seen her since they had left. Over the next 2 weeks, 5 searches were conducted involving aircraft, helicopters, up to 300 searchers. No trace of Langer was found during the search. On May 12, 1951, her body was found 3.5 miles from camp at the Somerset Reservoir in the East Branch of the Deerfield River, an area that had only been lightly searched 7 months previously. Because of the condition of her remains, they were unable to determine her exact cause of death. There are no no leads in her death and disappearance. Nobody knows what happened to her. Whether she fell in the water again, whether she was attacked, there's no information there whatsoever. I mean, at least the family got the closure of finding her remains, but that's it. That's all they got out of that. Langer was the last person to disappear during this era, during this time frame, and the only one whose body was found. No direct connections have been identified that tie any of these cases together, other than the general geographic area and time period. Now, in more modern and recent times, there have been some more cases. On September 17th, 2019, a jawbone was found in the gravel pit near Somerset Reservoir. The remains were later identified as those of Jessica Hildebrandt, a 43-year-old resident of New York. Hildebrandt was nicknamed Red, and red is considered an unlucky color within the triangle, as it appears conspicuously throughout several of the disappearances. Another recent case in this area occurred in August of 2021. 73-year-old Joseph Schoenig was found with a self-inflicted gunshot wound in his red truck at the parking area of Somerset Reservoir. His body was discovered a few weeks after he had been reported missing. Well, let me know what you think. There you have it. The Bennington Triangle. And it's a weird one. I don't even know where to begin or what to think, because it's a pretty hefty list of unsolved things happening there. I will say there's also other reports I didn't really nail down. These were just some that really like stood out to me. But if you look into that whole area there, there's several disappearances. There's a lot of really strange occurrences. There's some pretty weird territory around there. So yeah, throw me a follow over on Instagram, check out my, Patreon, reach out to me. Let me know what you think. Give me some feedback on this and tell me what you think happened to these people. Give me some of your ideas as to what you think happened to these people in the Bennington Triangle. So be sure to follow us on Instagram at Twisted States. If you like what you hear and would like to get some more exclusive behind-the-scenes access and support the show further, check out Twisted States on Patreon. Links will be in the show notes or the description, whether you're listening to this on your favorite podcast platform or watching it on YouTube. So check it out, and I will see you next time. Bye.